Lecture 18, The Progress of the Reformation in Germany.
In the last lecture, we saw that Luther had gotten a hearing before the Diet of Worms, before he would be declared an outlaw in empire. And on his trip down to Worms from Wittenberg, he was cheered on by huge, enthusiastic crowds of supporters all along the way, which pretty much amazed Luther because he never realized that his ideas had gotten out that far and that he had such broad popular support. But now he's beginning to realize that. When he arrives in Worms, he goes directly to the hall where they're having the meeting of the Diet, and enters the hall. It's kind of like, imagine a basketball stadium where you have a floor and then around it raised seating. And Luther comes in on the floor level and he's walking in. And around him on the raised seating are essentially all the big politicians and rulers and political figures of Germany. Princes, dukes, counts, you know, all the rulers of the small states. A lawyer from the Pope, a representative from the Pope, a lawyer from the Emperor, and even the Emperor himself, Charles V. And as Luther walks in and he sees this whole scene, he's stunned. Because remember, Luther's a rather simple man. He comes from peasant background. And to come to a place with all this assembled nobility was just really daunting for him. And he's kind of meek about it. He walks into the room, he kind of looks around and continues on up to the front. And at the front of the room, there's this table. And on the table, there are a bunch of books. And, you know, he's just standing there for a second. And then the imperial examiner, the lawyer of the emperor, gets up. The emperor himself doesn't actually talk, of course. The examiner points to Luther and points to the table and says, "Martin Luther, are these your books?" Luther goes up and he pages through a few of the books and kind of looks at him and he says, meekly, "Yeah, these are my books." The examiner then says, "We are going to give you one chance to recant what you've written in these books. And if you do, we'll give you pardon. If you don't, you'll be subject to the consequences under law." And Luther's first feeling is that he should say, "Yeah, okay, I'll recant it," because, you know, he's scared. He's really scared. And he's on the verge of saying that. But then he remembers all those people that turned out as he came down on his trip to Worms and how they cheered him and how they said, you know, he was their hero and all that and the support he had. And he thought to himself, "Now, if I recant all this, I'm going to look like a hypocrite and I'm going to just basically, you know, turn on all these people who are supporting me and betray them. I mean, how can I do that?" So he's going back and forth and he's not really saying anything, just thinking all these things. And the examiner says, "Well, I can see you're having a difficult time with this question, and it is a very serious question, so we will give you 24 hours to think it over. Come back here same time tomorrow and give us your answer." That Luther agrees to, because then now he can put it off and he can think about it more. So he goes back to his room, the room we took in the inn, and has, you can imagine what kind of night he had. I mean, probably didn't sleep a wink, thinking about what was going to happen to him if he didn't recant, but then thinking about all those people counting on him and how could he really, you know, betray all those people. And he went back and forth all night. Next day, he goes back to the assembly, walks into the same setting. He's not quite so cowed this time because he's seen it once, and so he's a little bit more confidence, although still, you know, he's a relatively inexperienced person in things like this. The imperial examiner puts the question to him again, "Will you recant?" And Luther answers no. He says, "These are my books. What I've written in these books, I wrote because of what my reason has told me, what my heart has told me, and I think it's right and true what I've said here, and so I won't take it back. Here I stand. God help me. Amen." At that point, the examiner says, "That's your answer. You now have 48 hours more free conduct before the law will come looking for you," essentially. So Luther goes out, he gets on his horse, and starts riding as fast as he can to try to get as far as he can back towards Wittenberg in the time allotted to him. Night falls. When the next day arrives, Luther has vanished. There's no trace of him on the road. There's no indication where he's gone or what's happened to him. He didn't make it back to Wittenberg. He's just vanished off the face of the earth almost. A lot of people think that maybe the imperial forces had secretly arrested him and taken him away. Maybe they'd even killed him and buried him somewhere. I mean, people don't really know what to think. What had actually happened was that representatives of Luther's prince, the Elector of Saxony, had in the middle of the night kidnapped Luther and taken him off to a secret castle location in the heart of the Black Forest, a place called the Wartburg Castle. And he's dressed up in clothes like a noble. They give him a sword, and they say, you're going to stay here and be in hiding for a while, and your name is going to be Junker Johann, or Noble Johann. So while Luther's in hiding here at the Wartburg Castle, he's being protected by the Elector, because the Elector sees him as a valuable political asset to be used at a future time against the emperor or even the pope or other forces. And he's a very famous person and a valuable person that the Elector can use. And that's why he kidnapped him and has put him in hiding here at the Wartburg Castle. Nobody in Germany knows that Luther's there. Even the people at the castle don't know it's Luther. Just a few people know what the actual truth is. While Luther is in hiding at the Wartburg, his ideas spread fast across Germany. He gets many, many followers from all classes of society. Many ordinary people become followers of Luther, even in his absence, not knowing what's happened to him, because they see him as a German patriot standing up against the foreign pope, which, you know, that inspired them. Other ordinary people took Luther's idea of salvation by faith alone as their own personal solution to their spiritual anxiety, because it did for them what it did for Luther. It got them over the hump of how can I be saved? So just lots and lots of common people followed him for that reason. Also, lots and lots of princes and politicians became followers of Luther, but for slightly different reasons. Their reasons were that, for the most part, they saw in Luther's rejection of papal control over the church a chance that they might take control over the church in their territories and therefore get control over its appointments and its revenues and its lands and increase their own state power in that way, which would be a part of the trend towards new monarchy, actually. And this is eventually what happens, in fact. And a lot of humanist scholars follow Luther because they see his ideas, especially his ideas about Bible reading, as being close to theirs. Well, while Luther's in hiding, back in his hometown of Wittenberg, strange stuff is happening. His followers back in Wittenberg, without his guidance and leadership, essentially get out of control. Lutheran crowds begin to do things that Luther never would have sanctioned had he been on the scene. They actually attack priests in the streets. They break into churches and destroy religious artwork. They reject the Mass and stop going to it. All sorts of extreme things. Among the leaders of these crowds is a man named Andreas Karlstadt, a former colleague of Luther's at the Wittenberg University. Other players in this drama are a group of people called the Prophets of Zwickau, who have come from a nearby town to be a part of the mix. They claim to have divine revelation directly from God that Luther's ideas are all correct, and they've been sent to kind of lead people. You know, so it's a very, very controversial, difficult situation in Wittenberg. Eventually, Luther hears about it because, I mean, you can't keep things like this quiet for long, and Luther becomes extremely worried. He realizes if he doesn't do something to regain control of the situation, it could very easily just spiral completely into a disaster. So he makes the decision to leave Wartburg, give up his hiding and his disguise, go back to Wittenberg, and try to get things under control. When he goes back to Wittenberg, at first everyone's glad to see him because, you know, they're glad that he's alive and well, apparently, and he's come back. But of course, Luther is in disagreement with a lot of what's happening in Zwickau and immediately begins trying to head things back in the direction he sees as being the correct one. And it's not easy, because once a situation, a kind of mass situation like this, gets this far out of control, it's very difficult to rein it back in again. And Luther finds that he's got to go around to all the churches in Wittenberg, making repeated sermons to the people, trying to convince them that they should do things differently. Among the first things he does is he says, these prophets of Zwickau, they don't have any divine revelation. God doesn't give divine revelation directly to people to carry out his orders. So these guys are frauds. And he also just urged everybody in Wittenberg to exercise moderation. He said, what you're doing is just wrong. You've gone too fast, too far, and you're doing things that aren't right. You shouldn't be attacking priests. They're not your enemy. We've just seen that they're not what they claimed to be previously. So, and you should keep going to Mass, because if you don't go to Mass, you might not be saved. You know, so Luther's really conservative here. You can see he has a conservative nature in some ways, and he's trying to get his supporters to back off. And eventually, because he's a convincing speaker and because he puts so much energy into it, he's able to regain control, and Wittenberg quietens down. However, this really causes Luther to have some reservations about what he'd assumed would be the course of his Reformation. He previously had assumed that he could carry out a reformation of the church by preaching directly to the people and just convincing them to follow him. But now he sees that especially ordinary people can easily misunderstand his ideas, and they can twist them and take them in their own directions, which could be very harmful and could be very, very different from what Luther had intended. So he starts to wonder whether he can carry out his reformation on a popular scale like this, whether he can preach directly to the people and be successful. And you can see why he worried about that. But something happens next which convinces him that this worry is absolutely legitimate. And in fact, what happens next will change the whole course of the Protestant Reformation in Germany. That is the Peasant Revolt of 1525. Now, later on in the course, we're going to be looking in much greater detail at the Peasant Revolt, as a matter of fact, in the next lecture or two. But right now, I just want to show how the Peasant Revolt fits into the bigger picture of the Reformation. What it is a massive, and I mean massive, revolt of peasants all through southern Germany and into central Germany, starting in 1525. Peasant revolts weren't that unusual in the Middle Ages. You know, we've already seen there were numerous in the 14th century, but this is a huge one. And it's different in that they use Luther's ideas as support for their rebellion. They claim to be revolting against authority because of ideas that Luther put forward. Well, this is an amazing set of events. The peasants are actually revolting against taxes. Landlord taxes, government taxes, that's their real gripe. But the problem is that you can't legitimize a revolt by saying you don't want to pay your taxes. There's no precedent for gaining legitimacy for a popular revolt based on really any kind of claim, but especially the claim that you don't want to pay your taxes. And so instead, the peasants, who are led by some Lutheran preachers who drift into the situation, claim to be inspired in their revolt by ideas that Luther has put forward, especially in his book On Christian Freedom. In On Christian Freedom, Luther wrote, "The true Christian is not governed by the law." Now, what he meant was the true Christian is dependent on faith, and his salvation is not determined by the laws of the church, really. The peasants believe that Luther's saying that if you're a real Christian, you don't have to follow the law. And so they're rising up against the law. And their goal is nothing less than to overthrow the rulers of society and take power for themselves. take over society. It's an honest-to-goodness social revolution. And as such, it's just what every noble and ruler in Europe has always feared, that population might someday rise up and try to take over. And in that sense, it's a real revolution. Revolution means the bottom goes to the top goes to the bottom, and that's what they're trying to do. And they're using Luther's ideas as a legitimization of it. Other ideas they claim as legitimizing this revolt, in On Christian Freedom, Luther wrote that all people, rich and poor, are equal in the eyes of God. Now, what Luther meant there, of course, was that all people are equal in the eyes of God, meaning when they go to heaven. And that, you know, there's plenty of biblical testimony to this, that everyone passes the same test when he goes into heaven, whether you're rich or poor on the earth, it doesn't matter in the next life. And that's what Luther was saying. But again, the peasants interpret this to be saying that all people, rich and poor, are equal in the eyes of God on earth. And they're saying, well, we've not been treated as equals, so we're going to rise up and demand we be treated as equals. We're going to take what's rightly ours. We're going to claim our position. We're going to be equals. You know, that's the rhetoric that's coming out of this huge peasant revolt. The peasants are simply attempting to overthrow the rich and take their share of wealth and power. They even claim that the Bible supports them in this. They say, well, you know, the Bible says the meek shall inherit the earth, and we're meek, and so we're now in the process of inheriting the earth. It's hard to overestimate the drama of a situation like this. Most peasant revolts in the early modern period were simply furious, undirected, unthought-out riots of starving, impoverished people who were rejecting, you know, maybe a wage freeze or taxes or other cruel treatment by the leaders of society and by the landlords. And peasant revolts are always crushed and always amount to very little, although causing much chaos, destruction, and death. This is the first time that a peasant revolt, or in fact any kind of revolt, had adopted religious ideas as a kind of ideology to claim a whole lot more than exactly what their agenda was. How many of the peasants actually believed that these ideas of Luther were spurring them on, and how many were just, you know, cynically using them, there's no way to know. It is interesting to note that, you know, the revolt is led by a number of Lutheran preachers, and these Lutheran ideas are certainly filtering into the masses through the preachers. What the preachers' motivations, intentions were, again, is not clear because there are no records about it. But the peasant war, as it's called, peasant revolt, is a traumatic event in German history. Even today, it's remembered as a disaster. And in those days, it just changed the course of the entire Reformation. When Luther heard what was happening, I mean, think about Luther's reaction to the Wittenberg situation, which was a relatively small-scale explosion of extreme activity, using his ideas as a foundation and basis. But now you got a massive popular revolution sweeping across almost all of Germany, involving tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people using Luther's ideas as legitimacy. Well, Luther is horrified, because politically and socially speaking, Luther is no revolutionary. Politically and socially speaking, Luther is a pretty conservative guy. And the first thing he sees, the first thing he believes, is that the peasants have heard his ideas and have totally misunderstood them, like many people in Wittenberg had. And certainly that was in part the case. Probably a number of peasants had just simply misunderstood Luther's ideas, or they'd been taught something about Luther's ideas that wasn't correct. You know, so there is that possibility that there were a large number of people just mistaken about it. But it also dawns on Luther that his ideas are being used. They're being cynically used for purposes that aren't his at all and he would never support. And he starts to realize that the ideology of the Reformation, which is essentially his ideology, can be more than just transformative in the theological realm. It has the potential for being a socially revolutionary doctrine. And this frightens the stuffings out of Luther. Luther honestly believes, and most people in Luther's position at that time believed, that these peasants are inferior. They are an inferior class on earth. Maybe when they go to heaven they won't be, but now they're inferior. And he believed that totally and wasn't at all willing to change his position on that. He ended up writing two books, which he hoped would kind of end the peasant revolt, but, you know, I guess it's wishful thinking to hope that a book will end a social uprising like this. In the first book, his major message was that the Bible demanded that citizens obey their rulers, because those rulers are put on earth by God to rule. They are ordained by God to rule. It's part of God's intent and plan they rule, and that people have no right to rise up and overthrow these rulers. In fact, if you do rise up and overthrow them, you've essentially gone against the Bible and become, I guess, a heretic. And I really think that was the core of Luther's political belief. But that didn't have any effect. No one really listened to that very much. His second book really shocked people. He came out and said, essentially, to the princes and rulers of Germany, this revolt by the peasants is not just illegitimate and dangerous. It's worse than that, because the peasants are inspired by the devil. So it's diabolical. And it's your duty to go out there and crush this rebellion and, you know, kill peasants. The rulers then are glad to do that. They form armies together. They go out into the field. They crush the peasant revolt, slaughtering who knows how many thousands of peasants, making a huge impact on German society for many years to come. At this point, Luther is absolutely certain that the common people will probably misunderstand his ideas. And he gives up the idea of reforming the church by directly appealing to the people. His new plan is this. He will preach instead to the princes and rulers of Germany. He will convert them to Lutheranism. And then they will in turn convert their territories and the people in them by law to Lutheranism. So it's going to be a kind of reform by government decree. This begins the stage of the Reformation known as the Magisterial Reformation. And it's called that just from the German word Magister, which means ruler or, you know, authority in German. And what it shows you is that the Reformation, which had started out being a popular movement, and we can see it was a very popular movement. I mean, you know, think of all the people who turned out on Luther's trip to Worms. Think of all the people who became followers while Luther was in hiding. I mean, it was initially a grassroots, popular, mass movement. Now it's turning into something else. With Luther's change in strategy, it's turning into essentially a political movement. Because Luther is going to become dependent on the princes, rulers, politicians to essentially carry out the Reformation. And when you do that, what happens next is pretty obvious. Religion is going to get mixed up in politics. Politics is going to get mixed up in religion. Issues that initially are religious issues will be political issues, and political issues will become religious issues. And you're going to have a kind of intertwining of these things, which can become very, very complicated. And I'm not at all sure that Luther thought through much of this when he determined the new course he was going to follow. And I doubt very much he saw the future consequences of it, which essentially will be the division of Germany into two parts and the outbreak of disastrous religious warfare between Catholics and Protestants. But that's a little bit farther down the road. as it turns out, by the way Luther is going here, preaching to the princes and having them convert their states, the new Lutheran churches that are established become state churches, controlled by the state. And I say churches, not church, because there really is no one Lutheran church. There's a separate Lutheran church in every little territory and province and princedom that converts Lutheranism. So there's a Saxon Lutheran church, there's a Brandenburg Lutheran church, there's a number of different churches, but you know, they're all Lutheran, following basically Luther's ideas, but they are controlled by the state rulers, the state governments, and they are basically state churches. This movement, though, begins to really pick up steam and appears to Luther to be working out very well, because he finds that there are a lot of princes out there, a lot of rulers in Germany, who will happily convert themselves to Lutheranism and then happily convert their state and people to Lutheranism. Why are they so happy to do it? Is it because they believe in Luther and like his ideas? I mean, that's possible in some cases that was you know, why they did it. But in most cases, I think you have to look at more political motivations. Most of these rulers are going to jump at the opportunity to reject papal control over the church. Because once they reject papal control over the church, they can take control over the church, at least in their territories, which means they will have the power to make all the church appointments, which means immense amounts of patronage. They will have the ability now to take those church revenues that used to go off to Rome every year and put them in their treasury. They will be able to use church land in ways they want to. I mean, and there are many ways you can use church land, and the church owned a lot of land. The church probably owned something like a quarter of the total amount of land in Germany, or something near that, and now these princes will have access to that land. Either they can use it to extract revenues from it, you know, if it's land formerly owned by a monastery, which has peasants working on it. The peasants are producing agricultural products that are being sold, and then the profits go to the monastery, which is always the way it used to be when it was a Catholic church. Now what's going to happen is that the prince will be able to take the profits of that land. He'll pay some to the monastery to keep it going if he wants to, but in many cases they just simply abolish the monastery. In many other cases, all the monks just leave and the monastery just doesn't exist anymore. But land, you know, owned by the church, coming to be owned by the state, can be used to extract revenues in that way, or you can simply appropriate that land and sell it. Sell it to the highest bidder and put the revenues directly into your treasury. So they're happy to do it. They're happy to make the church essentially a department of their state because it increases state power. But what we see here is a basic change in church-state relations. Throughout the whole Middle Ages, the Catholic Church had fought doggedly to maintain a separation of church and state, basically to maintain the church's independence of action from secular rulers. And now what you have in every Lutheran state is that the church and state separation has vanished. And the church becomes essentially a branch of state. Well, still we got to organize this church somehow, and Luther sees the necessity for organizing these new Lutheran churches. The Pope's gone, the bishops are gone, there's no leaders. People are asking Luther, who's going to govern the church? Luther says, the princes will govern the church. They'll be interim bishops, and they'll be the rulers of the church, the leaders of the church. So he hands them the authority over the church. Luther himself is willing to only be a theological advisor. At one point they say, will you be head of the church? And he says, we got rid of one pope, I'm not going to become another pope. So he doesn't want any kind of position like that, but he'll be an advisor. They set up consistory councils, kind of committees to rule, govern the churches in various areas to make sure they're following as much as possible Lutheran doctrine and practices. Luther himself does make contributions. He writes a catechism for young people in the new churches. He writes up a new church service with a sermon at its center and hymns singing, many hymns himself, he himself writes. And his probably most important contribution, he makes a German translation of the Bible, which ordinary people can read. So we now have the Lutheran churches established, the Reformation well on its way, and Luther is still, in some sense, guiding it.